Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is What's New in Pathologist Productivity and Compensation Plus Boosting Profitability Through Effective Negotiations with Hospitals and Payers. The presenters are Al Sermon, Founder, Pathology Practice Advisors, LLC, Pawleys Island, South Carolina, and Robert Tessier, MPH, co-founder and panelist, Panel of National Pathology Leaders, Woodbridge, Connecticut.
So today what I'm going to do is give you some foundation of 52 years worth of work in consulting and practice management. The first 20 or so of the years were working with radiology practices and and most recently working with pathology practices starting in 1982. So realistically, we're trying to be very precise about some of the information we're providing. We're trying to be as concise as possible, and that's what we're trying to provide to you today. So what I'd like to do is start off with the concept of building the Great Wall. And again, this comes from the Chinese Great Wall strategy, and what we feel is very important relative to any pathology practice, which obviously includes starting with the professional component, as well as global billing for referred services, and finally, professional component, clinical pathology billing. It's amazing to me just how many practices do have the professional component activity, but ultimately don't have global billing for referred services, or they don't have the professional component, clinical pathology. Beyond that, we're talking about the importance of working with including pathology, pathology assistants. And we believe very strongly that a pathology assistant in practice can be a tremendous asset relative to the cost of a pathology assistant doing works that's not traditional bench work, but doing work to support the practice in the administrative aspects of the practice, doing outreach, logistics, things like that, sales and marketing, et cetera. So we believe also that it's important that with a pathologist doing Part A and Part B activity, they capture time studies, and they do time studies in an effective way. A lot of people doing a time study is almost like bringing a pathologist to a dentist to have a volunteer root canal. You've got to do time studies. You've got to convince the administration as to how much time you're spending and what this time is all about and be able to produce it on a regular basis. So we really believe that doing these time studies on an annual basis are really important. And doing the time studies without having a dialogue with administration and the people in the department doesn't make the case. You don't wait for the hospital contract negotiation to be coming up every 3 years. You've got to do it on a regular monthly basis, regular annual basis. Prepare a complete fact book on this thing. You also want to be active in the State Path Society. You want to worry about providing input to state and legislation, the national legislation. Join advisory boards from third-party programs, and also volunteer for local charities. Provide leadership in the medical staff, join hospital committees, interface with the accountable care organizations, prepare a SWOT analysis of the practice, have an annual planning retreat, do a 3 to 5 year strategic plan, and develop goals and objectives that are goals and objectives that are consistent with the hospital administration. And don't be sitting there thinking about goals and objectives that are specifically for the practice. Then what about other aspects of this in terms of maximizing the wall strategy? An effective marketing plan is hugely important. Develop an alliance, the possibility of working with local hospitals and commercial laboratories. I can tell you that many times over the years, I've seen pathology practices that are very insular, working in their own silos, never bothering to meet the people down the road, 50 miles away, finding out what they're doing, communicating with them. I don't have time to do it. It's extremely important to make those relationships and develop the relationships. Develop the possibility of a combined regional histology or cytology laboratory. We've had great experience in Connecticut, for example. A number of years ago, we developed a Pap smear screening laboratory. We're doing 150,000 Pap smears a year for 6 pathology practices in 5 hospitals. It was very successful over about 5 year period of time in controlling costs and doing things that were effective for both the pathologists as well as the hospital. Group purchasing. A lot of people have completely forgot about the possibility of doing group purchasing for a variety of pathology practices. outsourcing global billing for professional component clinical pathology activities. We believe very strongly that it's important to have a separate entity when it comes to PCCP billing. This way you can continue to do the billing internally, or you can send the billing outside to a billing company. Again, the small volume, the large volume, and the small dollars make it appropriate not to simply bog down your billing operation doing PCCP billing internally from our point of view. Establish important compliance efforts between the hospital and the practice. Work together on those things. And more important than anything else I see is having the pathology practice and the hospital working together on 100% charge control. It's so unnecessary advice, I see it, to have a situation where the hospital is only billing 80 or 90% of what they should be billing, where the practice is effectively billing 100%. So work together with the hospital to make that happen. The concept at the top of the pyramid is developing a department fund. Oftentimes, the hospital people that I talk to in finance tell me the pathologists, the radiologists, the anesthesiologists don't make any contribution back to the institution. We feel very strongly the importance of establishing a department fund in a nonprofit institution and making some sort of a contribution back to the education of the staff in the department, and these days also to talk about the possibility of funding the development of digital pathology. Developing a situation where you can get people supporting the department through some sort of a additional support that's coming in, as well as proposing and participating in hospital fundraising efforts. So those are the things that over the years we felt those are all the components that make a successful practice that are completely different from practices who are not successful. Talk about pathologist productivity, for example. In 2019, we did a study, this from the panel of national pathology leaders, where we took a look at about 1,400 pathologists and what the activity was for these 1,400 pathologists in private practice. We concluded that the average pathology WRVU was about 7,500, and the median value for pathologists was about 6,500. So we are looking at doing the same thing in 2023, and we're basically talking to this audience and other people to say we'd like to do as many as 2,000 pathologists throughout the country. To the extent that we're doing this through our own organization, our think tank organization, what we'd like to offer to each of you is that if you participate in the study with us, we will give you a copy of the study. We'll identify everybody who's involved with it, and we'll provide the information to you. So on the next page, on the pathology productivity study, it basically tells you how to get involved with doing and participating in this pathology productivity study. In most cases, when you go look at national information, the information available from private pathology practices is very limited. We're looking to have, as I said, somewhere in the ballpark of 1,800 to 2,000 pathologists participate in it. On the next page, we talk about specifically what the experience was in 2019 relative to productivity. And here you can see, again, we broke the practices down from a size of 1 to 3 pathologists up to 25-plus pathologists. We concluded that 6,582 was the median. The mean was about 7,452. If you look at the following page, we take a look at that one step further, and we talk about the 75th percentile versus the 90th percentile of productivity. Here you can see at the 75th percentile, we're talking about pathologists doing 9,300 workload units a year. At the 90th percentile, as much as 12,000 workload units a year. And obviously compensation directly ties into that. One of the concepts we have that we've discussed in the past was taking a look at two individual practices, two private practice groups, both of which is doing about 10,000 workload units a year, and we wanted to kind of show you what the difference was relative to compensation for what we call the innovative practice versus the people doing things at the norm. So this particular practice on the right-hand side, the folks working at the norm were being paid about $400,000 a year as a pathologist, together with about $75,000 worth of fringe benefits and other costs associated with doing it. The practice that was the innovative practice, however, the compensation for that same pathologist was $578,000 a year, again with the $75,000 for associated with the benefits and payroll taxes, et cetera. So we've got two pictures down the bottom. One was a Podunk Community Hospital, and the other one was a big city institution. The group that was the most successful was in the Podunk Community Hospital. They knew their community. They were working with their referring physicians much more effectively. They weren't as city slicker, if you will, of the folks on the right. They were more attempting to do things as they thought was appropriate, but really getting down, doing things much more detailed was the way that they were successful. So if we take a look at the different sources of income, for example, the practice that was more innovative was generating more in the way of Part A support. They were generating roughly $125,000 of Part A support per pathologist, compared to the group that was considered to be the norm, only generating about $50,000. The people who were innovative were also putting in a performance-based incentive plan, and each of those pathologists were generating about $10,000 a year from the performance-based incentive plan. On the Part B side of things, the practice that was the more innovative practice every year had gone to the third parties and talked about third-party negotiation, raising the bar. The practice that was the norm was complacent and wasn't spending the time and effort to do that. So as a result, one practice versus the other one, using the same volume of activity, roughly the same third-party payer activity, was doing about $50,000 more per pathologist in Part B reimbursement. They also had global billing for referred services, which I mentioned as part of the Great Wall strategy. They were generating $25,000 more per pathologist because they were billing for the technical work. And then finally, the PCCP, which mentioned before, doing $100,000 per pathologist versus a non-PAR group doing about $60,000. So there's money to be made there depending on PAR versus non-PAR status. And then finally, the last component of this was they had relationships with GI practices. One relationship said they were going to get paid at the Medicare rates, or about $40 for an 88305. The other practice was working with a percentage contract with GI practices. They were bringing in about $20 for 88305. They also had a technical component differential on the GI practices that brought in about $25,000 more a year. So there's so many different ways that practices can be more effective relative to breaking things down, doing things in more detail. Taking a look at the next page about billing system costs. So the more innovative practice was working with a billing company that had performance incentives. They weren't satisfied to simply say, we want to get the best possible deal. What they said to their billing company was, we'll pay you 8% for billing our professional component, but they also said, we're going to give you 0.25% more for four different incentive criteria. Were you doing 1 month of accounts receivable? Are you doing 15% of your work over 75, 90 days? So they had various incentive arrangements. So the most effective practice was having this incentive arrangement with their billing company. They were paying more, but they were getting much more in the way of results. And I think sometimes people forget about the fact it's just not a matter of getting the best possible price. It's getting the best possible results. This innovative practice supported marketing efforts, and they paid for more marketing activity. They developed a sales plan. They also had a cost associated with a pathology assistant. So one practice said, no, we don't need a pathology assistant. The other one said, yes, we want one. And the practice that had the pathology assistant was splitting the cost that each pathologist was absorbing $25,000 of the cost of a Path A to help them run their practice. They also participated in department fund, which I mentioned before, and each pathologist contributed $25,000 to the department fund, which put them in a much better position as it relates to dealing with hospital administration, negotiating Part A support, getting what they wanted, improving the equipment situation, because they felt that the pathologists were contributing to the efficiency of the department and to the betterment of the department. And they also paid some more money for management services. They outsourced the management services. They said to the management company, we'll pay you more money if you do more creative things. They didn't want a management company that simply restated what the billing company was giving them every month. They said, you need to do better. You need to show us where there's greater opportunity. And so therefore, the practice that paid more for the management company got more management activity and had more of an effective practice arrangement that they negotiated. So those are some of the things that, relatively speaking, can make a difference between an effective practice operation and just a so-so situation. So let's take a look at most recent pathology data and compensation, because that was one of the things that Robert Michelle tasked me with to do this today. And we talked to a consulting firm that does fair market value studies, and we talked to companies that do the work in the consolidation of data. And in today's environment, the information we received as of last week was that the 75th percentile of compensation for 2023 was $450,000 for a pathologist. Again, that pathologist is doing approximately 8,300 WRVUs a year and generating roughly $600,000 of collections. They broke it down for us between private practices and those that are hospital-employed practices. There was not really much of a difference, which I was very surprised about. The FTE compensation for a private practice was $465, doing about 9,000 WRVUs, and the practice that's hospital-employed was generating $457,000 and $8,750. So I was very surprised. In the past, we've done these studies, and we've seen that there's a differential of something in the ballpark of about 10%. But in the most recent information that was provided to us by a national study firm, the numbers weren't so significantly different. So, again, this is information that come to us from significant amounts of data that are consolidated from a lot of different survey companies, and that 450 is, as I said, the 75th percentile of what we're seeing. Information is available at the other percentiles, but ultimately we think 75th percentile is a good way to think about it. In addition to that, we also put together information that we had for purposes of study, and we also talked to Rich Cornell at Santee Consulting, as a person that we've worked with over the years in terms of recruitment of pathologists, and this is information that he provided to us. He talked about Medscape studies and some other information. I'll let you read it at your leisure for the next couple of pages, average starting salaries, et cetera, but I believe that for purposes of the limited amount of time we have today, I just wanted to talk about what the 75th percentile was and also suggest the relative value units of the 75th percentile, and these are things you can take a look at your leisure. Okay. So let's take a look at the other aspects of what you don't see in fair market value studies, which is benefits. So what we did in 2022, we put together a benefit summary, and we took a look at what different practices were paying. So this today, as we're doing our WRVU study for 2023, we're also taking a look at costs associated with the various things that are provided in addition to salary. So we've concluded on balance that about $75,000 is the total cost associated with doing the costs other than simply the salary portion of the pathologist compensation for senior pathologists. I can tell you that the information we've gotten in so far has indicated that the starting point is about $80,000 and the high number is about $125,000. So it's going to take so much more, as you say, in today's world of recruitment and retention to maintain pathologists, people are offering more in the way of benefits, they're offering more in the way of the retirement plan and other things. So those costs are going to considerably go up versus what they were in 2022. But we're anxious to dig more information, put the information together, and share that information with a broader audience. So that's one of the things we'll be talking about in detail. Again, salary companies don't do this. They strictly look at WRVUs. They look at compensation, but they don't look at the cost of benefits. They'll say, well, maybe the cost of benefits is 15% or maybe 17%, something like that. So we feel that it's very important that you actually break down the costs in much detail by the individual practices and make that information available and compare it. Yes.
Compensation on the first page, when you're talking about the 460 and the 465, does that include the benefits or not?
No, that's just salary. That's just the information from the salary companies that produce the information, and that's why that whole concept of the fringe benefits and payroll taxes and everything else has to be added on there. And they're very much in the clueless about having that information being available. You have to look at individual practices and see what they're doing. So let's take a look at hospital negotiations a little bit and see if I can get some words of wisdom in here. As part of the first column in hospital negotiations, if people know what's going on, they have a concept of the Medicare reasonable compensation equivalent. And the Medicare reasonable compensation equivalent hasn't changed since 2015, has been that a pathologist is worth $260,300 to do Part A activity. Well, $260,300 is roughly equivalent to a salary of $200,000 and a fringe benefit package of about $60,000. And as any of you know in this particular room, you can't buy the most junior pathologist for a salary of $200,000 and spending $60,000 for benefits. But that's what the federal government says is reasonable, and that's what they put on hospital cost reports. And the difficulty is it's very difficult to negotiate, especially when fair market value companies are constantly telling their hospital participants that that's the number that's reasonable. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to share with you some information that we got from a recent national study back in 2022 that said that the medical director 50th percentile compensation was $452,000 in 2022, and at the 75th percentile was $518,000. If you take a look at these numbers without going through the details of it in terms of inflation adjustments, et cetera, basically, in the RCE concept, a pathologist is worth $160 an hour in the first column. However, when you start talking about what a medical director is worth at the 50th percentile, and you add up the items that go along with it, that same medical director is worth $240 an hour. That's the nature of what you should be talking about with the hospital administration. And at the 75th percentile, that person is worth $274 an hour. So when you start talking to and argue the case with hospital administration, what's my pathologist worth in terms of Part A, the first concept, as I mentioned before, is doing detailed time studies, having this information available and sharing it with administration, getting them to buy into it. And then the most important part of the compensation situation is what's the average hourly rate? And I think you can see that from the standpoint of a national study, they have concluded that $240 or $274 at the 50th and 75th percentile was what a pathologist is worth for doing Part A activity. This is not anything to do with Part B and patient care activity. This is for doing Part A activity. So if you take the number of hours that your pathologist is working in a hospital setting and you multiply it by this $240, $274, and compare it to what you're currently getting for Part A, you can see what kind of a difference there could be and what kind of opportunities there might be. Next page, we talk about what's the current situation in terms of hospital negotiation. With 1,000 open positions that Rick Cornell would talk about, you know, you have to raise the bar. You can't be talking about what you were doing 3 years ago, 5 years ago, burying your head in the sand. A private practice person should be making somewhere in the ballpark of $520,000 a year. Again, we say the 70th percentile. And benefits and taxes, about $80,000. Doing RVUs, about 9,000 RVUs a year. In a comparable situation in academic practice, the difference is that the compensation would be about $500,000 with $90,000 of payroll taxes and benefits and about 7,500 WRVUs a year. So if you're representing an academic practice, your numbers are about $500,000 per pathologist versus you're in a private practice situation, you're roughly talking about $600,000. Tactics for recruiting and retaining pathologists. Well, first of all, every practice, in my opinion, has to be committed to digital pathology and AI. And we've learned over the years that the kind of numbers we're talking about with digital pathology and AI implementation is about a 25% cost savings. So if you start talking about a pathologist whose compensation to the practice is $450,000 with the benefits and everything else, if you can achieve a 25% savings, it's a huge consideration. And now the big question becomes, who's going to fund this? So now you're in a private practice group in a hospital situation, and you go to the hospital administration and say, we need $3 million a year to fund digital pathology and AI. They're going to say to you, what contribution are you making? And I'm going to tell private practice groups they should be thinking about making a contribution by way of a department fund, by participating in some way, shape, or form in a department fund. If you've got a big private practice that's running a large laboratory operation and you've got a significant commitment to that laboratory operation, obviously it's the private practice that's going to be supporting digital pathology. So it really depends very much significantly on what kind of a setting you're in. If you're in an HCA setting where you're an employed pathologist with HCA or with Lab Corporation of America or Quest or whatever, it's a very simple conundrum because the net bottom line goes to the same institution. But if you're in a private practice situation and you're asking the hospital to start supporting digital pathology and spending millions of dollars a year to do it, it's a very difficult kind of discussion, and it's going to have to be something that is entered into in a very careful way because, again, it's the practice, the private practice, is going to benefit from the savings of digital pathology more so than the institution is going to benefit. Yes, the institution can claim world-class care. It can talk about second opinions and everything else, but ultimately it's a difficult discussion that's going to have to be had. And then obviously we believe strongly that another tactic for effective recruitment and retention is social responsibility strategy, and practices have to be doing much more than they are doing presently to maintain and show good works for working in the community and doing things that are beneficial to the institution. Every hospital is a nonprofit hospital. Must produce a study every single year indicating what the values in the community are, what the necessities of the community are. And if you, as a practice, if you're in a private practice situation and you're in a nonprofit hospital, not to have a copy of that study and not to review it and find out what the needs are and to have the nature of the pathology practices tie into the issues of what concerns in the community are makes a significant mistake. You have to be part of that dialogue, and you have to recognize that information is available, and you have to share that with administration and work with them to help it make it happen. Hospital negotiations. Another aspect of this that we'd like to talk about, and again, what are we doing time-wise?
You good?
Okay, fine. I'll talk fast. Another thing that a lot of people talk about is Medicare reimbursement. And I think that it's really important. We did this study about 6 months ago to take a look at Medicare reimbursement as it relates to 2024. In the country, for an 88305, the professional component varies from $33 to $48. There's a 143% swing from the lowest Medicare payment in the country to the highest Medicare payment. If you're in Arkansas or you're in Mississippi, you're getting the lowest Medicare payment in the country. If you're in California, you're getting the highest Medicare payment in the country, as well as Alaska, if you will. So just to give you an idea, I mean, we're talking about huge amounts of money as it relates to the technical component of an 88305, for anywhere from a low of $174 to a high of $293. So we talk about the Medicare program as if it's this generic unit that nothing is different about it, but there's a huge difference between what's going on in one state versus another state. So when you start negotiating with a hospital and the hospital says, I want you to pay me the technical component based on Medicare rates, it all depends on where you are in the country. That technical component can vary significantly. And one of the things we found, if the hospital is asking you to pay the technical component based upon the Medicare rates, is that when you start looking at the cost associated with doing the technical work based upon slides and blocks, we usually find that the cost is somewhere in the ballpark about 68% to 70% of what the cost, what Medicare is proposing as being a fee. So if you're simply paying the hospital the technical component but doing the referred services based upon Medicare, depending on where you are in the country, you could be paying a significant amount of money above and beyond costs. So understanding the difference in Medicare reimbursement from the highs to the lows, looking at things like maybe the average or looking at where you are in a state that's California, for example, that might be at a high level, you might want to evaluate that much more carefully and simply appreciate the fact that Medicare is not Medicare when you go throughout the country. We talked about, again, in terms of negotiation, doing time studies and educating the administration. I believe very strongly in doing two time studies a year for a two-week period of time. That usually is very effective. I can tell you that some of the last consultations we've done have been working with large institutions, and they've brought us in as the negative consultant to take a look at what should the pathologists be paid. And whenever we come back and do a study and the pathologists provide the information, we really are much more demanding of saying it ought to be 2 weeks a year, two time studies 2 weeks a year, and that would be an effective documentation process. So we believe that if you haven't done a time study in 5 years, it's about time to get one done, because you can't have an effective negotiation with a hospital about Part A unless you're doing it. Another consideration is preparing an annual report. I heard a wonderful CAP webinar a number of years ago from Dr. Steve Ruby and Dr. Breckenridge, and they talked about the importance of an annual report. We forced a number of practices we had doing Part A negotiation to do an annual report. It was extremely well received. It was done properly. And basically, they just followed the letter format of what CAP had recommended. And the hospital administration said, I had no idea that's all the things you guys were doing, the marketing and everything else, the improvement that we're doing with employees. So the annual report following the format of CAP was a very successful idea with our situation and got significant rapport with hospital administration. And also, the other thing to consider is fair market value studies. Hospitals will go out and hire companies to do fair market value studies. I can tell you those studies are significantly different. Every one of the fair market value studies starts with, you should pay the pathologist at the reasonable compensation equivalent, which again is baloney at $200,000 of salary and $60,000 of benefits. There's definitely improvements that can be made. There's a lot of different people who do fair market value studies, and you've got to come up with something that's acceptable to the practice, not simply whatever somebody's coming up with who's a hospital's a person doing the work for them. So you've got to understand what's going on, get the information, and take advantage of it. The one thing that we'd also like to talk about is simply identify what you're doing compared to what's going on in the department. In other words, the hospital administration has a tendency to think the medical director of the department is doing everything in terms of Part A. No. You've got to break it down. Every one of the pathologists has got to be on a chart. This is one of the first three pages of the charts that we use, and identify the X's. What's the medical director doing? What are the other members of the practice doing? And we guarantee you that there's a significant amount of surprise in that when you break down the activities and what different people are doing. Who's taking care of blood bank? Who's doing chemistry? Who's doing X, Y, and Z? So it's really important to have a very simple chart like this. Even if you don't want to go to the efforts of doing the detailed time study, at least break things down this way in detail and show people that there's a lot of the participation in the practice beyond simply what the chairman of the department is doing. And then ultimately another hospital contract negotiation situation is that every single state has a wage index that they use for the ambulatory payment classification, how the hospitals get paid for outpatient services. This happens to be the chart for the state of California. So you can see, if you look at the national number, which is 1.0, it's basically saying that if you're in Anaheim, California, you know, your compensation, your wages should be 25% higher than what they are nationally. So when the government payments are going out to the Medicare program, they're recognizing that 40% of the government payments are based upon the national norm, and 60% of the payments are adjusted for this particular wage index. If you're physically located, as I mentioned before, in Mississippi and Arkansas, you don't want to handle this at all. You want to deal with it from a standpoint of negotiation. If you're in a high-ticket area where it's 110, 115%, in Connecticut, for example, we're at about 120% of the national norm, you want to take this into consideration as part of what the norm is. You don't simply want to listen to a fair market value company saying, well, throughout the country, this is the norm. No, you take a look at what's going on in your individual state, and you pay attention to it. So another aspect of hospital negotiations, and again, I apologize for running through this, but ultimately the concept is get as much information to the audience as possible. We very much believe in performance-based incentives, things like you can save money on blood acquisition costs, the practice gets 10% of the savings. You can avoid sending work out to send out testing, the practice gets 25% of the savings. You have a CAP medical director certificate, you get $10,000 a year. You have a great turnaround time within 24 hours, et cetera, a certain percentage, you get $20,000 a year. So adding performance-based incentives into a contract that makes sense for the hospital and for the pathologist is a huge step in the right direction. Third-party contracting, next page, we'll call it the third-party pledge. I find that one out of three practices, and Al can speak to this a little bit, have an effective contract book when you go into their practice and say, we'd like to take a look at your contracts and find out what's going on. Probably one out of 10 have a contract book that's sitting with the billing company if you hire an outside billing company. The communication there is very, very poor, and it's extremely important to kind of follow this third-party pledge, which, again, will just basically tell you the various steps that we think would be effective for third-party negotiation. I'm not going to go through the different items in the pledge altogether, but ultimately take a look at them when you just get a copy of the presentation. And I can tell you that this information comes from the fact that over the umpteen years of my business, I've done well over 300 third-party negotiations, and I believe that these are the most effective steps to maintain a maximum third-party contracting relationship. I can also tell you, in my previous experience in dealing with third-party contracting, you used to be able to get away with two or three or four back-and-forths of a negotiation. If you can have an effective contract and do less than six, you're either not doing your job or you're dealing with somebody who's extremely easy to deal with, because it never happens. The first thing that happens today is everybody we talk to at Blue Cross, at Aetna, at Anthem, they want to get back with a 2% adjustment for inflation or 1.5% adjustment for inflation. You have to stick with that 3%, 4% adjustment for inflation, and you have to duke it out with them. But beyond that, the big consideration is on third-party contracting. Never contract by saying, we're going to simply adjust all of our fees that we had before by 3%, 4%, et cetera. It's just not the best way to do it. So ultimately, when it comes to the concept of third-party negotiation and third-party strategy, I just want to talk about a couple of things to wrap up my portion of the conversation, talk about selective contracting. We believe very strongly that the possibility exists for selectively the practice or the hospital, depending on the relationship you have with those institutions, to selectively contract. So it could be that the practice bills the global activities for Blue Cross activity, the hospital bills activities for Aetna, Cigna, et cetera. We find that almost no practice ever finds out what the hospital's reimbursement is. I find in many cases, in an effective situation where you have a good dialogue, hospitals are getting somewhere in the ballpark of 3 to 4 times Medicare reimbursements the practice is getting. And when I sit down with a practice and say, well, we're getting 150% of Medicare, which is nonsense. So we've, in fact, had this happen a couple of times. We've gone to the hospital and said, can we piggyback on your contract arrangements? And we've been able to do this pretty successfully. We did it with a large academic institution. Again, good communication, good dialogue with the hospital. They basically said, yes, our billing costs are 2 to 3% of what the money we bring in. Your billing costs are 8% of the money you bring in. You pay us our billing costs. So now we take the billing costs for professional component, reduced it from 8% down to 3%. In addition, they say we will give you the same benefit of our contract process. The contract process the hospital has, they're getting three times Medicare compared to what you're getting into Medicare. You say, look, piggyback us on that arrangement as well. We had one practice that generated, this is a practice of 10 people, generated $1 million more a year by piggybacking their technical, their professional contracts on the hospital contracts. People don't think of that strategy. It used to be the days when everything was combined, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, and then pathologists separated out from what's going on with the hospital. And now all of a sudden you've got to come back and think about more creative strategies of pulling it back together again. And to the extent you have a good hospital administration to deal with, if you're providing an excellent service, if you don't have a lot of friction, there's possibilities of saying we can reduce our billing costs by not necessarily being adamant about hiring our own billing company or doing it ourselves. Let's piggyback on top of some of your costs and contracts. And that has worked out very successfully in more than one occasion that we work with people on. The other consideration is on third-party strategy, and I've said this at a recent meeting of the CAP Practice Management Committee, take advantage of any published fee schedules. And here's an example of a published fee schedule for workers' compensation in the state of Connecticut. And workers' compensation basically says if you compare Medicare numbers, let's say for the professional component of $36.92, Medicare reimbursement, the workers' compensation reimbursement is $83.35. So they're getting 226% more on workers' compensation. We find that workers' compensation is a great way to compare what the current contract is to what you're currently getting and what they could negotiate. So ultimately, third parties, because they see in radiology settings that about 5% of the activities could be workers' compensation, they're willing to concede that workers' compensation is a published norm. So in many states, we've worked with workers' compensation rates, we presented those to third parties, and we basically said, this is a great published standard. We believe this is something you should think about accepting. So again, to the extent there's anything like workers' comp or anybody else in the state that might be a published number, we wanted to think about negotiating based upon that type of situation. And then finally, in terms of carving out codes, here are the four codes that represent basically 70% of all the action. So when I said before, you go across the board in a contract, you never go across the board in the contract. You take a look at the fact that, from Medicare's point of view, that roughly 40% of all the action is in 88305. And then you have the 88307, the 88341, and 342. Those four codes represent 70%. So what we try to do, and when there are various third parties say, we want to talk about having everything being the standard state rate, you say, look, I can accept your standard numbers, but my chairman of the department says they've got to have these five codes separate and distinct, that there's a great deal of pride in what we're doing in certain areas, and we just want to carve out five codes. We found a situation where we can accept the statewide rate, but then have these carve-out codes getting a 5%, 7% differential can significantly increase the reimbursement to the practice by using the concept of carve-out codes in third-party activities. Another consideration is, again, we're okay?
We got, 15 minutes
left. Okay, well, I'm going to do two more minutes, and then we'll let Al pick over. Okay. Another consideration is fee transparency. Fee transparency, on the next page, is talking about what are people doing throughout the country, and we've done this study recently for what's going on, and the only database available is 2021. So the 50th percentile for an 88305 throughout the country is $173. The 75th percentile is 225. That number is very significantly the same as what it was the previous year. What we find is, quite honestly, there's a lot of practices that have no clue what's going on in terms of what people are charging for fees, what to accept in terms of third-party reimbursements, et cetera. You've got to kind of understand and put your practice in the norm, and by appreciating what's going on with that information, you can do that. And I think I would give you an information base that says every practice in the country is available in the Medicare database. So we thought we would like to show you what's happening if you were dealing with a prominent academic practice throughout the country. And you can see that if you're at Johns Hopkins and you're doing an 88305, you're going to charge $144 for that 88305. However, if you're sitting at Dartmouth, you're going to be charging $445. Which is pretty ridiculous relative to the highs and lows, so to speak. And one of the things that caught my attention a lot is the fact that when people do third-party negotiation, they don't pay attention to the fact that third parties are looking at these huge swings in what pathologists are charging throughout the country between what's going on in Idaho and what's going on in California, what's going on in other places. So you've got to kind of know what the norm is. One of the things we did as part of the panel of national pathology leaders, we did a statewide report for the Medicare database in 2021. We sent it out to the state society offices of every state. And so basically you can have this information by getting in touch with the state society office and say, look, we'd like to see the study of what's going on in our state, and this information is available. Every single pathology practice in the state is listed, what they're charging for the 88305 and 7, et cetera, what your colleagues are charging for it. So, again, maybe people have changed since 2021, but the information is available, and it was done as a published study, so might pay attention to it. And then ultimately, the next page is basically just showing you the range of all the states in the United States and what people are charging. So if you're in Nevada for an 88305, you're charging $230 for $220 for an 88305. And then if you're down in Idaho, you're charging $73 for the same service. So it just kind of gives you a range of the state. But I can also tell you that we go to a state like New Jersey, we find that people are charging numbers that are in this particular chart. But ultimately, you'll have practices that are charging $700, $800 for an 88305, which boggles my mind to find out what people are charging and what a self-pay patient is getting paid in the way of a bill. It's absolutely crazy. So ultimately, the information is available. The federal government makes it available. It's very, very easy to find it, so you really have to have this kind of information. And if you have a hospital contract that says your fees will be usual and customary, I don't know how a practice is charging $445 can say my fee is usual and customary when the rest of the community is charging $200, $250. So the concept is whenever you are looking at a contract relationship, make sure your fees are reasonable and customary. And just because one payer who's paying you a half of 1% is going to pay you 100% of whatever your charge is, don't go crazy and bill $500 for an 88305 and recognize and say that's reasonable. So again, I think I've talked about strategies a little bit about the piggybacking. And one final thing I'm going to leave you with before I give Al a chance to talk for 2 seconds here is the fact that the one strategy that I found recently, the most successful strategy, is if you're having problems with a third party in negotiating, get them on site. Mandate they take a tour of the department. Mandate they talk to the person in the practice who's the most effective negotiator. Mandate they come back again. We were talking recently with a payer, and I'll be very specific, UnitedHealthcare. They offered us 150% of Medicare rates. We got them on site. They were there for 2 meetings. They met on 3 different occasions. They were most upset to have to come back to the hospital to talk to people. We finally got them to pay us 250% of Medicare rates because they were just tired. They were worn out. Their attitude is they want to wear you out. They want to say, look, come back to us with a proposal. Oh, back and forth, back and forth. You come visit us. You come take a tour of the department. You meet with our key people. You take a look at what we're doing, and you need to wear the third parties out, make sure they get a fair reimbursement for you folks, and ultimately bring it to the hospital because that is the one significant bellwether that's going to get some significant progress being made. So that's my most recent experience in dealing with third-party strategy. It's been very successful whenever we've mandated they come and do this, so I want to pass that point along, and I apologize. We'll let Al talk for a few minutes.
That's quite all right. I'm from South Carolina. I don't talk quite as fast as Bob does, but I just got 2 reports I want to talk to you about. You know, many years ago, maybe one of the – can y'all hear me okay? Many years ago, when I think I came to one of the – maybe the second or third DARC report meeting, Executive War College, Robert Michel said, you need to know your numbers. And if you don't know your numbers, they're probably worse than you think they are. And since then, 20-plus years later, I've found that that is the case. When I work with pathology practices, I work with 2 things. There are accounting systems, and one of the reports I like to look at is the profit and loss statement. So I say this, do your homework. So before you go meet with your hospital, look at your profit and loss statement. You know, many pathology practices use Quicken for their general ledger accounting system, which is fine. It works well. But one of the problems with it is it has a pre-templated profit and loss statement in there that starts off with A for accounting, B for bank charges, C for courier, whatever. you need to really change that and prepare a classified profit and loss statement like you see here. And what we try to do, sometimes these profit and loss statements have 200 lines. We try to condense it into one page. We break our expenses down into three major categories: direct lab cost, selling, general administrative, and then physician expenses. And by doing that, you can come down, you take your total income, less your direct lab costs, less your SG&A costs, and you come down to income before physician expenses. You know, most of our pathology practice report on the cash basis, and if you ask them what their net income was at the end of the year, they'll probably say zero. So that doesn't tell you much. So the number that we try to look for is that net income before physician expenses. So I'd encourage you to do that. So I think having a classified profit and loss statement is very helpful to understand your costs. The second thing I would say to do is take that and departmentalize it. I think you need to have at least three departments or three columns, if you will, one for your hospital work, one for your outreach work, and then one for administration. So then you can take that profit and loss statement and then you can break it into these three departments. So in your hospital work, you can see what you're making from reading the surgical cases in the inpatient and outpatient setting. Under your outreach, you see all your work that's coming from the physician's offices, you know, surrounding your hospital. And then you can look at your administration. So like Bob's talking about, if you're going to go negotiate with your hospital about your Part A contract, you can look at that administration cost, and you can see the income you're generating from both your Part A fees and the billing for the professional component, and then compare that to your cost. Well, with that, you don't have a whole lot of cost, but you do have a physician that's in charge of that. So when you come down there to the bottom where you have to allocate your physician expense, you can do it several ways. You can ask the physicians, well, who spends how much time with the hospital cases? Do you have somebody that all they do is the outreach cases like the dermatopathologist? Or do you have somebody that's the medical director that spends maybe 80% of their time working in that setting? So once you do that, you can allocate your physician expenses between the three departments. Then you have a pretty good idea of what your costs are on your profit and loss side. Kind of the same approach when we come to your billing reports. I know we have, when you're going to do payer negotiations, we have all your billing companies give you a lot of good reports, and it shows you your charges, your payments, your adjustments, and the receivables. If I'll just drop back to one report here, the final one, where it shows one here by your various payers. In this case, I believe we got all your payers here, then you have your gross charges for Blue Cross, I think, are like $5.1 million. We take that one report, that $5.1 million for Blue Cross alone, and we break it down by CPT code. And you can see it shows you all your information. It comes across and computes your benchmarks, your net collection percentage, your bad debt percentage, or your days and AR for that one CPT code for Blue Cross Blue Shield. Then it computes the average charge, which should be your charge amount, and then your average payment. Then you compare that payment to what the allowable is. So you look at your contract for Blue Cross and see what the allowable is. In this case, I think we're showing our average being 140. Maybe your allowable is 150. In that case, you're like, hey, I'm pretty close. We're about, you know, greater than 90%. However, what if your average is $100 and your allowable is 150? Well, what's happening? And there can be several things going on, and you need to find out what they are. What I started doing, instead of computing the average, I do a frequency distribution, and I see what is the most commonly, the mode, what is the most frequently occurring payment I'm getting from Blue Cross for a 305. Hopefully that's my allowable. Then I take a step further. What is the second most frequently occurring amount? Many times that's 80% of my allowable where the patient didn't pay their responsibility. Unfortunately, sometimes the third situation is, it may be for that 88305, it may be the 88305-26 is what I'm getting paid. And I got a problem with that payer has gotten mixed up and paying me on the wrong place of service. That has been a real eye-opener for me. And you don't catch that by just looking at the average. So it's really, that's why I'm doing those modes. If you take it out another one, do the fourth mode, sometimes you find that you got a lot of them, they're paying zero, that's your denials. And then sometimes you'll find that a lot of times they're paying the Medicare amount. And unfortunately, we have all these Medicare Advantage plans, and sometimes when the billing departments get that, they classify it as a Blue Cross Blue Shield, where it's really a Medicare Advantage. So you really need to know your numbers and know when you go to negotiate with that payer, the, you know, the first thing you want to do is get a good rate. But then you also want to make sure they're paying you what they say they're going to pay you. That's where I find there's a lot of room for pointing that out. The problem I'm having when I do that is finding somebody at the payer to talk to me. And it just seems like we really have a hard time finding a good contact. So it does take a lot of time. And I think their strategy is to wear you out because they're certainly good at that. I think you want to have some time for some questions.
Okay. If there are any questions, I guess we'll...
There's a couple questions. We've got two minutes. So. A
couple of questions, 2 minutes. Perfect.
A couple of questions, 2 minutes, Bob. You left everyone plenty of time. So let's see. Let's start. What are your thoughts about paying for tumor board prep time and separately for clinical lab director fees?
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, every single hour has to be accounted for. And the difficulty, as I said, oftentimes when I go into a situation, I say to the pathologist, give me a time studies. We haven't done a time study in 10 years. I said, how do you convince the administration of your value if you haven't got the documentation for it? They're going to expect that from anybody in the hospital in terms of time studies, and the pathologists have to do the same thing. So if you're going to have an effective negotiation, you have to have effective documentation. You have the annual report, you have the documentation, and you have an effective conversation.
Question around digital pathology. It's got a couple layers to it. Has anyone successfully negotiated the implementation of digital pathology with contracted pathology group? Was there a cost sharing of some sort? Any type of business arrangements that you can share?
Well, one of the things I'm going to do is release something that we came up with just a couple of days ago. And I'm going to tell you that right now, our estimate right now is the cost of doing a slide is $2.50. I can also tell you that something we came up with the other day from a large academic institution is that they took a look at the fact that they were fully digital, and their cost of doing the technical work in the hospital, 10% of that work was the cost of doing digital pathology. So it might be kind of interesting to at least appreciate that. The key thing is that practices are either not successful in moving ahead to digital pathology because they can't convince the administration to go ahead and do it, and that's why our think tank is putting together a toolkit for the implementation of digital pathology, and the concept is how do you convince the C-suite? So we've had conversations with about 15 different institutions. We expect to have conversations with 20, 25 by the end of the year, and we're ultimately going to say, how did you convince the administration to go ahead and do this? What kind of rationale were you using? What participation were you using in making this happen? And we hope to be able to have that information available for a wider audience by the end of the year and next year.
Okay. Last question, which I think will resonate with anyone who's in the PCCP space is, can you talk more, Bob, about commercial plans paying for PCCP? Are you seeing a lot of it? Are you seeing less of it?
The world is, it's not dead yet. Everybody says it's dead. Our experience is that probably there's an income about $50,000 per pathologist for PCTC activity. We find a lot of people just gave up on it. They said they didn't want to get involved with it. Therefore, they're giving up a significant amount of money. Every single month when we deal with a practice of four or five people and there's $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 coming in the door for PCTC, we think it's a very practical, very viable situation. And I can tell you that while Cigna claims that they are going to pay $5 per unit, we find that we continue to get paid much more than $5 a unit, on average $6, $6.50, something like that. And when practices are non-par, they can typically get somewhere between $7.50 and $9 from Cigna for those particular services. So the world of PCCP is not as dead situation that people talk about, and it's still a very viable situation. And for practices who don't do PCCP billing, they made a significant mistake because they're not going to get it from their administration with a Part A.
Okay. We are 2 minutes over. Thank you, everyone, for attending. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Al. Great session.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.